3, no longer dependent on foreign oil and all. We've got a long, long journey ahead of us in that regard, and we hope to learn a good deal about it next week. Of course, Bob has been very active in the coal problem, mining problem in West Virginia, and knows a good deal about this already, and I'm looking forward to learning. So we'll keep you posted on that journey to Washington, D.C., back to the Capitol next week. My, it just seems like we were just there. In fact, we were just there. So, hey, I do want to remind you that the program is a listener-supported program, and we are in a position, and we told you not too long ago that we're in a position of being yay or nay with the program, so we hope you'll help out. 866-546-5254. We want to thank Representative Cohen from Memphis, Tennessee, for being on the program today. A great, great guest, and he gave us a great insight into the stimulus program that's going on. So thanks for joining us here on the Guy James Show. Always great to have you with us. Another one of those days where, here we go. Proud member of the Head On Radio Network, and we'll join you again tomorrow. Listen to the Guy James Show. Don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, and thank you.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Good morning, America. Good evening, America. Good afternoon, America. Whatever time zone you're in. I've been reading about the details of the agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans, or at least the prospective agreement on the stimulus package. And, of course, what few Republicans agree are Arnon Spector, Susan Collins, and Olympia Snowe. The great majority of the Republican Party has declared war on the stimulus package, declared war on Obama, declared war on America. And I was trying to wrap my head around this. You know, I was trying to figure out why Republicans wanted so much misery. And let's face it, we are in the greatest depression since the Great Depression. Why could it be that Republicans were so determined to say no to anything, no negotiation? I mean, the Republicans were acting like, well, some terrorist groups. And in fact, one of them, Congressman Pete Sessions, Republican of Texas, actually gave the Taliban as an example of the Republican negotiation strategy. He said that he was acting not like a loyal opposition, but like an insurgency, that we, quote, understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. And that's what they went about, talking about the Taliban, talking about the Republican Party. And that's what they went about, systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban, I'm not trying to say the Republican Party is a Taliban. I'm just saying it's an example of how you go to change a person from their messaging. And we need to understand the insurgency may be required when the other side, the House leadership, does not follow the commands that we entered the game with, blah, 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 blah. The heart of the message of the Republicans and their leaders, whether it's Congressman Pete Sessions or whether it's their true supreme leader, their true religious leader, the one they all give obeisance to, the one they all bow down in front of his idol, the big fat idiot himself, Rush Limbaugh. Their goal is to make America as bad a place as possible. It's not just that they hope Obama will fail. They hope America will fail. And trying to wrap my brain around why it is the Republicans want to see so many Americans in misery at a time when our unemployment is up to 7.6%, and when you add the underemployed, those that want a job but are only working part-time or aren't in the job that they want, it is 14%, one in every seven Americans. When trying to wrap my head around why Republicans want us to be so miserable, well, really, it's, I guess, not that hard to understand. You see, George Bush took gold and turned it into straw, or really something far more putrid than that. Bill Clinton gave, bequeathed to George Bush, a very strong economy. Think about it. In 1993, at a time when no Republicans again voted, not a single one, for Bill Clinton's tax package, which passed by one vote in the House, which required Al Gore, his vice president, to break the tie in the Senate. At that time, the Wall Street Journal said that the Clinton proposal, which included a few tax increases on super wealthy people, will lead our country to a terrible depression. Instead, Bill Clinton gave us the single greatest economic boom in American history. Both in terms of length of time, 1993 to 2000, a good 8 years, in terms of jobs created, in terms of even the national surplus. We were booming. The rich were richer. The middle class was richer. The poor were richer. And the country, the government was richer. We had so much money, we didn't know what to do with it all. Bill Clinton talked about using it, part of the surplus, a third of the surplus, to pay down the Social Security Fund, to get rid of that entitlement program, too. To get rid of that, not the entitlement program, to get rid of the problems in that entitlement program, too. Times were indeed that good. They were so good that I remember Alan Greenspan going to the Hill, the Federal Reserve Chairman at the time, and arguing that it was dangerous because we were going to pay off our entire national debt, and what would we do with the money? We wouldn't know what to do with the money. Which kind of reminds me like complaining when you go to Vegas that you're going to win so much money that you're just not going to have a bag to carry it home. What will you do? Oh, no, I put a quarter in this slot machine and it's raining down millions and I don't have a place to put all the money. What will I do? That was their complaint. Times were that good. Times were so good that the only thing the Republicans could think to criticize, given our incredible economy, our massive surplus, the fact that the poor and the middle class were doing so well, productivity was up, and yes, there were no wars. The only war we fought was in Bosnia, which I think was completely justified. We stopped a genocide from happening. And the enemy shot down, killed not a single American. There were three that were dead in a plane crash. That's it. And we saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Times were so good that the only thing they could even think to criticize was the fact that Bill Clinton liked to get a little tail on the side. Not that I'm excusing it, but he wouldn't be the first, second, third, fifth, or 20th president to have had that predilection. That was it. We spent an entire year on what happened with Monica Lewinsky's dress precisely because there was nothing more concerning to the American people. So George Bush took this incredible, wonderful economy into the dirt. Even before September 11th, the economy started turning sour when he did what Republicans do, stole from the poor to give to the rich, massive tax cuts for the super wealthy, leaving the rest of us behind. and then he spent like there's no tomorrow. Not on bridges, not on infrastructure, not on things that actually help the country. God knows, not on levies to protect New Orleans. No, on Halliburton, defense contracts. And a bunch of it just, well, down the tubes. Like my personal favorite, the $12 billion in cash that just got misplaced in Iraq. Oops. Oops, you know. It's so hard when you have 20 tractor-trailer trucks full of $100 bills. And you just misplace them. You lose them. And one of the things that rarely is discussed is that what success we've had in Iraq does not come from a troop surge. It came from us paying off our enemies. Paying off the very insurgents that were killing Americans and, frankly, killing a lot of Iraqis, too. We paid them off. And now they say, when asked, do you want to kill Americans, or if they're Sunnis, do you want to kill Shia? They say not at this time. Not as long as we keep getting paid protection money, hush money, quiet money. Everyone just wants to be paid. In Pakistan, they want to be paid. In Afghanistan, they want to be paid. In Iraq, they want to be paid. They want to be paid not to kill. Hamas wants to be paid not to kill. Everybody, every terrorist group, the Taliban wants to be paid not to kill. But, you know, when the mafia comes in and offers you protection for a price, sometimes it's best not to pay that price. I guess I shouldn't complain. Things are a bit quieter, not much, in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at a time when we are shelling out money like there's no tomorrow, just seems like maybe we ought to prioritize what's happening at home first. But George Bush shelled out money like there's no tomorrow, and he shelled it out on people who really didn't use it to help the economy. Certainly gave a lot of it, as we know, to people in Iraq and Halliburton and people like that. But he also gave a lot of it to those people on Wall Street that then turned around and did the Vegas thing and gambled with it. And to be clear, some people made billions of dollars. Billions of dollars gambling right. If you want to know where all that money went, it didn't vanish. Oh, yeah, your 401k vanished when the stock market crashed in half. That certainly happened. But a lot of people got rich off this, gambling on the credit derivative swaps, just gambling the right way. And now we are in a huge mess. Really a mess that has no comparison outside the Great Depression. And it's not clear how to fix it all. I do think the government's trying. But the point is that George Bush inherited very good times, and in his 8 years, he brought us one short recession that, frankly, the economy was so strong after Bill Clinton, he tried to ruin it, but there was only so much he could do. And then, given a full 8 years, spending massive amounts of money at a time when we should have run surpluses rather than deficits, we are now where we are today. The worst times since the 1930s. Massive deficits. And now, the Republicans, who so supported all that massive spending in the good times when we didn't need it, who so supported giving all that money to those rich people that gambled on it, bet the farm and the houses and virtually all the real estate in America. Now that all the money's gone, now we're in trouble. And now the Republicans are saying, no, no more. No more. We Republicans spent like drunken sailors on things like paying off our enemies in Iraq, on things like Halliburton. We just lost billions of dollars helping our friends in the oil industry, corporate welfare, tax cuts for people doing hedge funds. Remember those? The very Wall Street people that were taking our economy down the tubes. And Republicans wanted to and still give them a special tax cut so that hedge fund managers pay a smaller percentage of the $100 million they earn a year than their secretaries pay on the $50,000 they earn a year. But now that Obama's in charge, now the Democrats are in charge, the Republicans are turning off the spigot. It's enough. No more spending. No more pork. They call it pork. Think about what they're calling pork. For a Republican, health care for a five-year-old dying of leukemia is pork. For a Republican, a police officer who would otherwise lose his job is getting pork. For a Republican, a school teacher who would otherwise lose her job is getting pork. The same is true with the firefighter who would lose her job. The same is true with the construction worker who would lose her job. When you look at the differences between the House and the Senate bill, the one thing you can't help but notice is that the Republicans most want to cut aid to the states, and the thing they most want to add is the alternative minimum tax. Now, what are those things? What do they mean? What do they matter? Well, the states desperately need funds right now. And what's fascinating is you see Republican governors like Charlie Crist of Florida, Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, standing with Barack Obama, standing with the Democrats in Congress because they need money right now. They need money because property taxes are down, because housing values are down, because state income tax receipts are down. And state funds are up. Even because of the recession, they've got to pay unemployment. They've got to pay disability. They've got to pay health care. They've got more funds going out, less funds going in due to the Bush Depression. But if Republicans wanted to help Americans succeed, that would be the first place they would give money, the states. What happened to, you know, local officials know best? But no, it's not. The most important thing to the Senate is an alternative minimum tax cut. What's the alternative minimum tax? I think many of you know what it is. It's when you take so many loopholes and so many tax breaks and so many ways to avoid paying taxes, and you're rich enough to do that, that guess what? You pay so little tax that Congress put in a special provision called an alternative minimum tax to make sure that you at least pay 15-18% because you're in the, you know, 30% bracket, 31% bracket, and you're paying less than the people in the lowest bracket. They want you to pay some. Well, that's wrong, the Republicans say. We want to make sure that rich people pay less taxes, fewer taxes, smaller taxes than those in the smallest tax bracket. So that's their priority, and that's $70 billion. If you note, the Senate bill is actually slightly more expensive than the House bill because while they took out spending on the states, while they took out education spending, while they took out spending for firefighters and police officers and teachers and health care, they put in that alternative minimum tax cut. And we'll get to the specifics of the bill. Actually, I do think that the compromise version coming out of conference is better than the Senate bill. And I just hope we get the two Republicans to sign on and get this out of the way. It's not as much as I'd like, but it is a good start. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the overall program, the one that the Treasury Department came out. But first, I just want to talk in general about Republicans and why they are the party of no. Because you may remember that in the Bush years, when the Republicans controlled the Congress, many Democrats broke away from their party. They didn't want to be the party of no. They wanted to say, well, you know, this isn't what we would have drafted, but it's better than nothing, so, you know, we'll support it. And many liberals complained about those Democrats. Well, the Republicans have adopted the Taliban strategy. Again, that's not my words. That's Congressman Pete Sessions' words. The I hope he fails strategy. Those aren't my words. Those are Rush Limbaugh's words. They want our economy to go down the tubes. And they want our economy to go down the tubes because right now everyone understands it's the Bush Depression. It's the Republican Depression. Everyone understands right now that it's the economic policies of George Bush and the Republicans in Congress that caused this colossal mess to begin with. Giving a ton of money to rich people, not regulating it at all, and then watching as they gamble our future away. Everyone knows what happened right now. But what will they think in November 2010? I think if Obama's plans come to effect, we can actually, by mid-2010, come out of this depression. I think we've got a decent shot. We can argue about the specifics. We will argue about the specifics of the stimulus package and the Treasury package. In fact, I want to talk about them all this hour. But if the government acts and acts quickly, the government, as the one party of last resort that can spend, can put stuff in now that in a year, yes, I expect the economy to recover if it's done. But what if the Republicans succeed in stopping it? What if the party of no actually derails Obama's policies? Well, then, by November 2010, we'd be stuck in a depression that might be even greater than it is now. After all, our direction is down. If you do nothing, it keeps going down. Then the Republicans can take over Congress, become strong again, and then prevent the rest of Obama's agenda, things like universal health care, things like giving D.C. the right to vote that the District of Columbia deserves to be treated equally as other Americans. Things like green jobs, things like getting us off of foreign oil, things like everything that Obama campaigned on, education, Pell Grant. You see, here's something that's obvious, obviously good for the economy. You will not find conservative economists. You can even look at the Reagan's economists or Bush economists, real economists. I'm not talking about Rush Limbaugh. I'm talking about people who understand economics. But even the right-wing ones, Milton Friedman, Martin Feldstein, will agree that we need a stimulus. There might be some disagreement over whether it should be $600 billion, or many economists think this one's too small. We should have $1.2, $1.3 trillion. But they don't. None of them are saying what the Republicans are saying, which is no. All we want is tax cuts to the rich. So if there's no stimulus and the economy goes down the hamper, the Republicans can then think that they're going to change the name of the Bush Depression to the Obama Depression. Vote all those Democrats out. Think about it. Here's something that obviously America needs. And the Republicans are saying no. What's going to happen when we get to things that are Democratic priorities? What's going to happen when we get to health care? What's going to happen when we get to higher fuel standards for cars? What's going to happen when we get to funding stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research? What's going to happen when we get to the Employee Free Choice Act, allowing people to join unions to strengthen workers' rights? Those things aren't considered necessary by everybody. Those are good, democratic, liberal, progressive priorities. If Obama has trouble with the obvious things we need, a stimulus package that right and left says we need, how's he going to do with democratic priorities? The one thing I do think he's gotten across, though, and I know that a number of liberals have complained about this, and I can't really tell whose side I'm on here. But what Obama did is he reached out to Republicans, very much so, and they slapped his hand. Now, a number of liberals, Paul Krugman and others, have argued that by giving Republicans most of what they wanted, and then they slapped his hand, Then he had to give them more of what they wanted. In other words, he started with one-third tax cuts, and they slapped his hand. And so to get the Republicans on board, he had to go to 42%. And maybe you shouldn't negotiate with people like that, starting with a position that's really a compromise position, a position where you basically give them what you think they would want anyway. That if you're going to negotiate with the Taliban, you can't start with giving them what they want. You have to start with giving them something that they don't, no tax cuts at all, as Obama said in his press conference, and then negotiate into it. But at least on this, I'm not so sure Paul Krugman's right, because I think the American people see that Obama reached out to the Republicans. I don't think they blame Obama. If you look at the latest Gallup poll, something I mentioned to Mike Lane in my show yesterday, 67% of Americans support Obama, 25% are against. 48% support the Democrats in Congress, 42% against. And a good 58% disapprove of the Republicans in Congress, with some 30-something percent approving. In other words, people understand that the Republicans are being obstructionists. People understand that Obama reached out to the Republicans and was slapped down. At the end of the day, I hope that it leaves that party weaker. That because Obama didn't start, you know, on the far left and then compromise to the middle, he actually started in the middle, and the Republicans still said no. Maybe next time he won't have to start in the middle. Maybe next time he can say, look, you know, I keep trying to reach out to Republicans. The door is open. If they don't want to come in the door, I'm just going to do it my way. And I think he's already saying that. I was very impressed. I'd be curious to know what you think. Call in 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'd be curious to know what you thought of Obama's press conference Monday night. I was very impressed. It almost took me for a loop to hear the President of the United States say almost exactly what I would say. It was a little weird. It was like I was channeling him. I mean, obviously I wasn't. Obviously this was Obama, but it was weird. I was so not used to a President of the United States saying reasonable things. Not promising the moon. Being very honest that we have some difficult times ahead, but talking about the specific ways to get us out of our crises. Saying he was willing to reach out to Republicans, but if they weren't going to play ball, then he was just going to get to 60. At least that's what I heard. Which is exactly the right thing to do. See if they'll play. If they won't play, you know, they're the Taliban. They said they're the Taliban. If they want to act like the Taliban, then you've got to roll right on over them. And so I've actually been pleased by the conference bill. Let me tell you, because we've already done some better things. First of all, the tax cuts, Obama originally had a third. It went up to 42% under the Senate bill, but the compromise bill is already down to 35%. That's pretty close to what we started with. It does create 3.5 million jobs. It gives more aid to the states. The original bill was $79 million. The Senate cut to $39 million. It's back up to $44 billion. Still not enough in my view, but it's more. More infrastructure spending, which I think is good, up to $150 billion. Tax cuts for 95% of Americans, which is what Obama promised in the campaign. Everyone making $250,000 or less will get a tax cut. That's good. That's keeping his campaign promise. Keeping the money for medical research, keeping the money for unemployment, for health care. And what's interesting is a lot of the provisions the Republicans put in that they didn't mean fell by the wayside. And I was really glad to see that. Senator Isaacson of Georgia threw in on a voice vote a tax credit for anyone that buys a house. It could be your second house. It could be your third house. People were calling it the flip your house to your brother $15,000 tax cut. And it was passed on a voice vote, and I think a lot of Democrats thought this would get them some Republican votes. Well, it didn't get them a single one. And even Senator Isaacson of Georgia didn't vote for his own proposal. He voted for his own proposal, but he didn't vote for the final stimulus package that included his own proposal. So you know what? They took it out. Good for them. I'm really actually liking the way the compromise is being set up. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's big enough. I think it should be more money. Certainly there should be more money to the states. Certainly there should be more money to education. I do think we can fix it in the sense that, you know, this isn't all of it. We're going to have budget bills. And the nice thing about budget bills is they can't be filibustered. So it only requires 50, which means, you know, 50, well, just 50, actually, since we have Biden to break the vote. And I do hope we're going to have Franken in the Senate quite soon to give us 59 Democrats. So we can get a lot of this stuff back in. The point is that for all the Taliban tactics of the Republican Party, I think they're failing. They're not stopping this bill from going forward. We're getting 90% of what we want. We can always get more later. And I think they look like idiots. I think they look like the party of no that they are. The polls show the Democrats are doing just fine. The main thing is to get this done and to get this done as quickly as possible to get our economy up and moving again. And as Lot writes in the chat room, we have a president that speaks in complete sentences telling us not with overreaching, not with promises he can't keep, but yes, soberly, we're in a big mess, but he's working hard to get us out. Wow. So, you know, I'm still in a good mood. And for all this talk of bipartisanship, I actually think it's going to help because Obama did reach out to the Republicans and they said no. And that's okay in my book. You know, it reminds me very much of the way Obama has said he would deal with our enemies. He would deal with Iran. He would deal with other dangerous entities in the world. Russia. He would reach out to them, and they could work with us, and if so, we could use diplomacy, and that's a good thing. And if they said no, fine. Fine. They're the bad guys. Then the whole world sees we reached out. They said no. Okay. We tried. We tried diplomacy. It didn't work. And I would not be surprised if a few Republicans come straggling back, tail between their legs, and vote for the final package. Not many, but, you know, there are a few moderate Republicans left, maybe three or four. People like Mike Castle in Delaware. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a few of them scramble back on. Because you know what they're trying to do? They're trying to say, they're trying to have it both ways. If we're out of recession by 2010, they're going to say, well, I support a stimulus. I just support a different kind of stimulus. And if we're not out of recession in 2010, they'll say, well, you know, I voted against this, so don't blame me. And I think our main job is not today, but in 2010, to remind people it was the Bush Depression, to remind people the Republicans were the party that just said no, and to help Democrats finally get the 60 votes they need to not have to worry about the party of no, and to really get the ball rolling. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. So this is the guy who's indispensable to solving the Rubik's Cube of our banking crisis? This is the guy whose tax problems we were supposed to forgive and forget because he's just so brilliant? Well, this Tim Geithner has already bombed as Treasury Secretary. He's over his head and wore over a barrel of junk assets that the banks can't unload. Geithner's solution? Much like Paulson's, except not only will the government bail out the banks directly, it'll also provide hundreds of billions of dollars to private investors to take those assets off the banks' hands. This is doubly obscene. It's obscene for the government to be subsidizing wealthy investment vultures when all around us people are losing their homes and their jobs, and it's obscene for the government to help the banks wipe their assets clean. These banks don't deserve to live. They made reckless gambles, and they lost, taking the world economy down with them. If you believe in free enterprise, they should go bankrupt. And if you don't believe in free enterprise, we should nationalize the banks. In many cases, it would be cheaper than paying investors billions to buy up the bad assets or having the government inject $1 trillion into the banks, which is what's happening now. Plus, when all was said and done, we'd actually own the banks and could make them do the lending that's required to get this economy moving again. Call it socialism, I don't care. What we have today is socialism for bankers and for investors. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. There is, of course, more than the surplus that's the big discussion in Washington, and more than Obama's press conference, and that is the speech by Timothy Geithner yesterday. And I Matt Rothschild has a point. Timothy Geithner, I think, did not inspire the best confidence in the world. I think this is still a plan in action. It's a bunch of people trying to get a handle on this horrific crisis. And let's face it, we don't have all the information we need. One of the things about this gambling, these credit derivative swaps that Wall Street was involved in, is that not only were they massive in scale, tens of trillions of dollars, but they were all secretive. They were all kept off the books. They didn't want to call them things like insurance or things like buying and selling of securities because, hey, those things are regulated. So precisely to avoid government regulation, they dealt in a shadowy world where it's hard to know what's going on. And I share Matt Rothschild's frustration. I want to see these people punished. I still think we can see the individuals who got us in this mess punished. And I want to punish even the people that profited. Actually, even especially the people that profited by it. While banks were losing billions, individual hedge fund managers, the ones that bet against the credit swaps, they made billions. How about a special windfall profits tax on them? And I don't mind some nationalization of the banks. To the extent that the government gets in there, when we give them money, we get preferred stock. That means we get paid first. And certainly no corporate execs should make more than, we'll say, a member of Congress, 170 grand, unless and until all the loans are paid off. But at the same time, I recognize that this is all a confidence game. Money is a confidence game. It is. That piece of paper in your pocket that represents a dollar bill has the same amount of value in terms of paper and print as the one that says $20 or $100. In fact, I think only your pennies are worth more in copper than the actual 1 cent cost on the coin. And, of course, most of your money is not in your pocket in paper bills. It's in your checking account or your savings account or in the equity in your house or in your car. So money has always been, at least since we got off the gold standard, a confidence game. You value it because other people value it. You value it because you recognize that the money that you have in your pocket is worth something. If you didn't think it was worth something, you would spend it as quickly as you possibly could to get rid of it, to get something that had value, like gold or a car or whatever. And for that reason, I don't go as radical, perhaps, as Matt Rothschild goes. I mean, I think if we take over all the banks, that would not lead to a lot of confidence in the system. The trick is, I think, to do the middle ground, the liberal ground, the progressive ground. It's something that is seen as a bad word on Wall Street and in Washington, but actually it's a word I quite like. It's called regulation. And you don't have to take over a bank to regulate a bank. You don't have to own all the banks in the country to say, banks, you're going to do the right thing, and if you don't, you're going to be punished. And don't just punish the banks, because they're corporations. They don't feel the pain. It's very hard to put a corporation in jail. It's very hard to even punish a corporation. You find the corporation, and does the corporation really hurt? No. I would go, as we say in the law, pierce the corporate veil. Go behind the corporations. Look at the CEOs. First of all, any of the CEOs who made these awful business deals, if they want money for their corporations, they're going to be out of a job. Now, part of the problem is that the way these corporations control themselves, and this is the problem with the corporate forum that I've argued about for years, is that their incentive is not to make the company rich. Their incentive is to line their own pockets with other people's money. I remember Alan Greenspan, just after this crisis began, must have been September of last year. I'll have to play that for you sometime. I'm sure you remember it. When he said that a fundamental economic theory of his, he made a fundamental mistake. He just didn't see why companies wouldn't try to maximize their profits. Alan Greenspan made the fundamental mistake of believing that corporations were people. And they're not. And I don't care how many times courts wrongly use the 14th Amendment to try to claim corporations are people. They're not. They are fictions, legal fictions. They are licensed by the federal government or one of the 50 states, and they don't exist. So corporations don't necessarily try to maximize their profits because corporations don't do anything because corporations don't exist. Corporations don't act. Legally they may, but in essence they don't. Who acts? The people running the corporations. And if the CEO can line his pockets while his company falls apart, well, why shouldn't he? Why shouldn't Michael Eisner take hundreds of millions of dollars while Disney falls apart? Why shouldn't Ken Lay line his pockets as Enron falls apart? Why not? Remember, corporations don't exist. You know, the old economic theory is that the corporations act to improve their profits because otherwise shareholders will vote the bums out. But shareholders don't get a vote. All of those elections for boards of directors on corporations have about as much freedom and choice as the elections to elect Saddam Hussein. There are 10 people on the ballot for 10 slots. That should be the first sign that this is not a fair election. And shareholders can vote yes or no. Do you know how corporate elections work? If there's 10 people on the ballot, and each of them gets one yes vote, and a million no votes, they win. One vote for yes, a million votes for no, and no votes for alternatives. They still win the election. The thing that gets me about this whole crisis is it's both small, greater and smaller than everyone's talking about. It's smaller in the sense that, yes, this too will pass. I think we will get past it. I think that our government is struggling, but we'll figure out what to do. Tim Geithner will get a handle on this. It's taken him some time. I understand that. We will get past this. But it's also bigger. Because the problem isn't, greedy people on Wall Street. The problem is the system. A system that rewards that greed. A system that has elections where only one person runs for each position. Frankly, a system that largely comes out of, sorry, Joe Biden, but your home state of Delaware, which a tiny little state races to the bottom, provides all these advantages for CEOs and not shareholders. There's a reason why people are taking money out of the stock market and sticking it under their mattresses or trying to buy treasury bills at 0% interest rates. They don't trust the system. One of the things the founders so understood in our government is that there's always going to be unscrupulous people. They're going to be good people. I'm not saying all people are evil. They're going to be good people who mean well, who are trying to do right by government. And they're going to be people who mean badly, who are greedy, who are corrupt. And that's why they devised a system of checks and balances. Pardon me if I sound like your 8th grade social studies teacher. But the damn thing is, for all the imperfections of the founders, the fact that, they loved slaves and didn't give women rights and only gave full rights, at least at the beginning, to Christian property-owning white men. For all their imperfections, the genius of our Constitution is the fact that everyone is watching everybody else with a suspicious eye. Congress is watching the president and the courts. The president is watching Congress and the courts. The courts is watching the president and Congress. All three of them are being watched by the press. The state and local government are jealous of federal authority. The federal government is jealous of the states. Everybody's watching everybody else. And when you have 1,000 people with 1,000 interests all watching and checking and balancing the power of everybody else, it's a little crazy, but it actually works. We need a system of checks and balances on Wall Street. We need businesses, yes, trying to make money at the same time as shareholders' interests are protected, which means that when shareholders and CEOs differ, the government, the regulator, comes in and helps the shareholders. You've got the government in there watching everything, not controlling everything. I don't believe in full nationalization of private industry. I'm not a pure socialist. But they want the government in there as a player watching Wall Street. Wall Street watching the government, shareholders wataching both. Even ratings agencies, who played such a tremendous role in causing this crisis, rating as AAA things that were junk bonds, someone needs to be regulating them. And the regulators need to be watched, too. Government needs to be open. Congress needs to be overseeing them. Everyone needs to watch everybody else. If there's one lesson of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, and there's more than one, but the essence of it was not Bernie Madoff was a thief. That, to me, is a very minor thing. You're always going to have thieves and greedy people trying to make a ton of money. The fault was in the SEC. The fault was in the cops. Criminals are a dime a dozen. I expect criminals to exist. The fault was in the cops. The fault was in the SEC not regulating him. The fault was in a belief by Republicans that regulation is a dirty word. Well, if there's one word I want to redeem today in my hour rant, which you're welcome to join in, by the way, 877-4-HEAD-ON. It's the word regulation. I love the word regulation. Regulation does not mean nationalization. It doesn't mean destroy. And it doesn't mean free market either. It is regulating. It is the essence of moderation. You regulate it. Like you regulate the steam coming from a heating pipe, right? You don't allow it all in. Or you burn up. And you don't allow none of it in. You don't stop it all. You freeze. You regulate it. It is moderation. What happened to regulation in America? Well, for one thing, we don't pay the regulators anything, so people don't want to do it. It is a bit of a thankless job. Everyone is mad at you. If you regulate too much, Wall Street and others get mad at you. You're shutting down free industry, free market. If you regulate too little and you miss a Bernie Madoff, well, everyone's even more mad at you. It is a bit of a thankless profession, granted. And yet it is essential. The hand on that steam pipe is essential to a functioning economy. And I don't blame Obama. I don't blame Tim Geithner for not having a full handle on the mess we're in. It's going to take some time. I'm willing to give them some time. I don't like everything they've done. I don't like everything they plan to do, but I don't think they're really set on what they plan to do yet. One thing I do understand, though, is that credit is the lifeblood of America. Whether it's, yes, your consumer credit cards, whether it's your housing loan, whether it's your car loan, whether it's businesses, you need credit. You need money. And the banks aren't loaning. So I think rather than taking over the banks, we need to regulate the banks. We need to require the banks to loan at least as much as they did before. Isn't that fair? No, not the subprime mortgages. But we could, for example, set a credit rating, a reasonable one, not the people that have no money down and want to own a mansion, and say, banks, you always loan to people with a score over 500 before. Are you doing it now? If you don't, we're not going to, you know, provide the funds you need under the TARP program. Give and take. Back and forth. Regulation. It's funny that anyone would have to defend this moderate point. With everyone crying, the sky is falling, with Republicans saying, get government out of the way, not recognizing that government out of the way is precisely what caused the problem to begin with. And some are saying, really the populace on the right and the left are saying, throw the bums out, close all the banks, nationalize all the banks. You know, if that worked, I'd be okay with it. But I think we're going to have to give some credit to existing banking institutions. It's just the system. It exists out there. You can't... It's hard to take over everything in a big rush and make everything work. So I say moderation, regulation. Yes, the banks that bought the worst credit swaps, don't throw away the bank, but throw away the people in the bank. Remember, corporations aren't people. You know, if there were people at Citibank that did these things, and there were, throw those bums out as a condition of accepting state funds, but don't close the bank necessarily. Just get rid of the bad apples in the bank. This is going to take some time. This is going to take some patience. At a time when the Republicans are going to be screaming, no, 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 we want everything to fail. And I say we've just got to give Barack Obama a bit of time. I also think we have to praise what he's done so far. The state children's health insurance program, remember that? Giving poor and lower middle class kids basic health care. Something that was so awful to Republicans that George Bush vetoed it twice. And they just couldn't get the two-thirds to override it. That's already law. That's already happening. Lily Ledbetter, the woman who was discriminated against because she's a woman and paid less, and our United States Supreme Court, bless their hearts, by a 5-4 decision, said that because she didn't know she was being screwed over until 30 years had happened, well, 30 years of paychecks, all of hers less than the men doing the exact same job, because she didn't know she was being discriminated against, oh, well, she couldn't sue. Already Congress and Obama have overturned that. So for all the criticism you're already hearing about Barack Obama, celebrate the things that have already been done well. Alan the trucker. Alan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
I just have one simple question. I think it's simple. I've been told that if a corporation is considered a person, then you can sue it.
That's true.
Than if it was a non-person.
That's true. You can sue a corporation, but corporations have limited liability. So what that means is that you can take all, once the corporation has no more assets, it's very hard to pierce the corporate veil. And, you know, you can have empty corporations that have no money in them. You sue them and you win and you take no money, you haven't really won. You understand what I'm saying, Alan?
So that's one of the reasons why they go bankrupt, because people sue them and they don't have nothing to sue them for, and then they leave a mountaintop gone and a bunch of pollution and all that stuff.
And then there's nothing to do because the corporation doesn't exist anymore, you see. See, the thing about corporations is, unlike people, they can have quick, easy death with no pain to the corporation, but lots of pain to the creditors.
So if the corporation is a person, considered a person, it's harder to sue the people who run the corporation.
It is hard to sue the people who run the corporation. It's not impossible, I should say, under the law. And it is called piercing the corporate veil. And if you can show that a CEO basically stuck his hands into the cookie jar of the corporation and took a bunch of money out unfairly, and there's all kinds of very complex law over what's unfair and what isn't, you can go beyond the corporate veil and go into the CEO's pockets, but it's very, very hard to do. Listen, the reasons people set up corporations to begin with is to protect themselves from themselves. Right? They set up corporations to begin with so that if the corporation goes bust, they're okay. Right? When Enron went bankrupt, the only way they could get Ken Lay was because under criminal law he had committed fraud. But otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to touch his assets. And then when he died, there was a strong argument made by his widow and heirs and so forth that, hey, it's not our fault. Don't blame us. Sure, you know, Dad stole billions of dollars from innocent people, but we get the money now because, he's dead. You can't punish him, and the corporation's gone. So we'll keep that. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And did keep a lot.
It was like highway robbery.
Well, it is to me, and that's why I don't believe a corporation's a person. I hate that. I mean, the 14th Amendment, it pains me that this amendment, after the Civil War, designed to not only free the slaves but give them equal rights under the law, a very powerful, probably the most important amendment of all of them to the United States Constitution, would be misused in the way to say corporations are a person. It's horrific. It's completely wrong. Look, if you want, I'm not saying ban corporations in America. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that they are creatures of the government, and therefore they can be regulated by the government.
Yeah, Alan, that law was slipped in there.
That wasn't slipped in there. No, this is constitutional law. This is an interpretation of the 14th Amendment. The only way this will change is if we change the Supreme Court or pass a constitutional amendment. It's a very it's a very bad interpretation, but it is part of our law.
Okay. Well, I don't like it either.
Well, what's that?
So I appreciate you taking my call, and I'll be listening.
Oh, hey, absolutely, Alan. Call in any time. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
And let me leave you with one more thing to think about. I want you to think about Elliot Spitzer. Elliot Spitzer used his own money. He didn't use state funds. He used his own money, and he's a very rich man.